Welcome to the third CineStory podcast. Once again, we offer our listeners a chance to sit in on a retreat informal room. In this session, writer-producer Meg LaFauve and writer-director Pat Verducci discuss craft topics such as writing from the heart versus the head, mastering tone, and executing exciting set pieces. We pick up the conversation just after a discussion of a thematic exercise that's become a hallmark of the CineStory experience. Enjoy.
I don't believe you can write with your head. I don't. I think you can write parts of the movie with your head, of course. And you can analyze what you wrote with your head.
You can outline your movie.
You can outline your movie with your head. But the writing is, you know, it's an experience. It's a, you know, some people think I'm an actor, and I'm like, no, I'm a writer. To write, you have to physicalize, try. And every writer writes different, so take it or leave it. But if you're writing up here, just try to write from down here. Try to get yourself into that emotional state. And then let the character tell you what happened. Just try. It's funny, because when I read a script, and especially when you're an executive and you've read like thousands of them, I can tell the moment the person left and went into their head.
Yeah. Mm.
It's like, oh my God, this is so emotional. And that scene and that scene, all of a sudden it goes. And what happened is they got way too close to something really scary emotionally, and their head went up here, up here, up here. You know, and you're like, the moment that she should really lose, she won, goddammit, because that didn't happen. It's like, yeah, it did. I'm sorry, but it did. Until you get the ball straight down,
exactly.
She's not going to change. So
and,
I'm sorry.
And when you guys are writing your scripts, don't you know when you're like in here? And like it's so much harder when you're in here because you know it sucks and it's not true. And it's like, you know it and you're like, damn it. Because, you know, I will find it. I'm writing a ghost story and I go in and out of like, what's the plot? And, you know, oh my God, she's so scared. And like, I literally have times where like, I'm scared. Like, I have to get up because I'm like,
that's good.
Something bad's about to happen. And then you love that.
You better not scared when I'm reading
it. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Or joyous, if that's the scene you're writing. Or tortured, or whatever. I mean, being a writer, people think it's all in your head. It's not.
You have to use your head.
You
have to use your head a lot. I overanalyze sometimes because of my old job. But, you know, you got to get down in there. You got to walk around all that muck.
And by the way, screenwriting is left brain, which is all that rational, organized, blah, 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 linear, and right brain, which is what Meg's talking about, sort of like the intuitive and the holistic. And so you have to use both sides of your brains when you write a screenplay.
Well, I do other exercises, like I do the thematic exercise, I do who's the actor and find their pattern, so that, you know, I can give you notes on what would be better, but might not be what you tune into, because it might not have all those metaphors and archetypes that you need. So sometimes I walk in and I think, oh, I know exactly how to fix this script. Mm-hmm. Look, don't you see this movie? Look at this movie. But the more the writer talks, the more I'm like, oh, yeah, you're not going to overwrite that. That has nothing to do with what you care about.
Writing.
It's not why you're writing it. Oh. But sometimes look at the flattest character, the one your brain does not want to talk about.
Yeah.
Does not want to talk about that character. And that's why notes are tricky. They're telling you to cut out a flat character because he's flat. That's a good note. Unless he's holding the juice, and you haven't been brave enough to give him a part in the movie. Like, sometimes I'll be like, killed that character on page 10. What would happen if you put that character in act 2 as the antagonist?
What would
And they're like, he's dead!
Just saying.
What if he wasn't dead? Suddenly we have a very big conflict and a very big problem. Look who you kill. How quickly do you kill them? So anyways, these are just fun little ways that I go sniffing for what, you know, where are you, your brain's going, no.
By the way, you guys all saw Glenn's movie yesterday, right? Which I did too. I thought it was fabulous. And that scene, the climax, where the girl says, nothing can save me. I mean, that's her facing that, the horror of that. And like, to me, that scene was incredible. And he went there. Do you know what I mean? He went there. And I thought it was great.
And comedies absolutely do this. I mean, if you've ever hung out with a comedian, they're some of the darkest, most unhappy people you've ever met. They're dark, man. They're really unhappy. But it comes up in this kind of reverse comedy thing. So comedy can be just as, you know,
deep.
Emotional. You're using the comedy to drill it up. It's the drill. Comedy is not about distraction. If you have comedy, it should be digging, you know? Mm-hmm. It's the stick you're hitting everybody with. And we laugh, we think it's funny.
It's aggressive,
it's
right?
aggressive. Comedy.
Good comedians, mm-hmm. and it's not really passive, it's aggressive. That's what makes it great.
All right, so that was theme. That's good? Is that helpful? Yes? Okay. You can do those 20 questions and see if you can chart yours. Chart your absolutely favorite film actor who, you know, would you like to be in every one of your movies. He's probably carrying your thematic, too. I mean, I think that's oftentimes when you get great movies, because everybody, the writer, the director, the studio executive who greenlit it, everybody chose the same thematic, is in the same boat. So you're all driving towards, you're all digging towards the same thing. If you hand somebody a script and the thematic and all this stuff isn't clear, and that you've left doors open for them to think, that's my thematic, mm-hmm. now the executives point to their thematic, now the director comes in and it's his thematic and he's playing it that way, you get a hodgepodge. It's funny, I don't know this, they were just talking last night at the mentor thing, that there's two scripts for Moneyball.
Oh yeah.
And they're both really, really good. One is written by Steve Zaillian, and one is written by West Wing.
Aaron Sorkin.
Are there better writers working? Those are some
Those
two
are
of the best writers in the world.
And they're fantastic
and
scripts.
And one is about baseball.
Yeah.
And one is about his daughter.
Mm-hmm. But it was also, the conversation turned from these two very different thematic scripts, which were both really great, to how each script had a totally different voice. Because they're different writers. And the importance of finding that voice for yourself as a writer, because like Meg said, when someone's reading that script, and even when you're writing it, you know when you crack through and it's you, it's your voice. And that's what's going to actually call attention to yourself. You're in the pile and they're going to go, bing, who's that? I want to know that. I mean, because it's so specific that it's compelling. So what's your voice? Like, what's your voice? And how
you
does
can pick
that
up a
through?
Steve Zaillian script, and in half a page, you know it's a Steve Zaillian.
Literally half a page.
Half a page.
He's
a genius writer.
Same with Sorkin.
Sorkin.
Yeah.
Well,
right?
Sorkin, you need two lines of dialogue. Yeah. I don't know anything about him personally. Whatever people think about him.
Woohoo!
I mean, that scene in the Facebook movie.
Yeah, it's great.
I mean, think about that. That's a movie about computers that they turned into a thriller. How? And there's like so much exposition.
That doesn't feel like exposition.
I mean, the scene where Justin Timberlake's character is sleeping with the girl, and the amount of exposition in that scene is unbelievable. And I'm watching it like I'm watching Picasso, and I'm in the theater saying to Joe, that was unbelievable!
Well, my favorite thing in that scene is, remember the girl gets up and she walks to the bathroom and like she's got Stanford on her
right.
butt.
Yeah.
And
it's just there. Stanford student. Like, and I'm sure that's written in the script. Like,
yeah.
she's wearing Stanford
underwear. It's like, okay.
So good. Okay. And that
yes.
is
yes.
But you know, when he goes toward his thematic, he drills.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You're down
so
in there.
So good. I mean, that's the other thing. You should be getting scripts of movies you love and read them on the page. Read them on the page. Watch how they're creating on the page. Get a script you love, read it on the page, watch it with the movie. When I first came to Hollywood, I did this with Thelma Louise, and it was shocking. Because the script is different than the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And where they edited, where they flipped scenes, was really interesting, because you're seeing the editor is the last
rewrite.
He's rewriting.
It's the rewrite.
And oh my God, it's so much better that way.
Yeah.
Or fuzz out.
And remember Glenn talked about yesterday how he re-edited his movie?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it works on the page, and you go, it works, I'm going to shoot it. And then you cut it together, and guess what? It doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
You have to rewrite it, and you have to be open to doing that. And so there's so many processes of just drilling in different ways when you make a movie. And you know, if any of you guys decide to direct or have directed, you know that, right? It doesn't always work on the page. On the screen. So
you should be reading them all. I mean, honestly, that's how executives know how to develop, because we've read thousands of scripts.
And
it's like music, that it's like it's an internal music that just starts to reverberate inside of you. So really, you should be reading every script you can get your hands on. The executives are reading 10 to 20 scripts a weekend. So You guys can read some.
And you guys know all about the databases that are out there, you know?
You can get any script you want. I mean,
they're all there.
When I was in the game, into the business.
You had to go to the Academy.
You had to work at the freaking agency to get the scripts. And if you worked at the agency, you were just like gold to everybody else. Can you get me this script?
A copy of this.
So
I don't know about those. Where do you get those scripts?
Oh, iScript. Let's see. I go to Simply Scripts. Yeah, SimplyScripts.com, Drew Scriptorama. Okay. Those are like the two biggest databases, and you just go on, and literally it says movies, and you click on movies, and like you go to A, B, C, all alphabet.
And be sure you look at the cover page and see what you're reading. Yeah. Are you reading a very early draft, which would be great?
Right.
Right? How great would that be to read an early draft?
And then compare it.
Read the draft with the movie as it's going, if it's an early draft. If it's a shooting draft, you're just only going to see editing, but it's still good to read it on the page, you know.
Yeah.
Jonathan was saying this to me at lunch one day, not here, but, you know, now the internet is so fast that when Tarantino turns in a draft, within 3 hours, it's on the web.
Oh, and can I...
Which is really hard as filmmakers, because he's turning in a first draft, and he's got it up on the web. I mean, that's just so exposing.
People have probably already talked about this in other informals or whatever, but... But you basically have 10 pages.
Yeah.
No, five.
Five. I mean, the attention span to get their attention. Because literally, they don't want to read your script.
They don't want to read your script.
You are messing up their weekend. You are messing up their life. You are messing up their... They go, like, the first thing... I mean, I know people who read a lot of script. They look at how many pages. It's like, oh, 120. They hate it already. Oh, you know. And so, if you can capture them... In the first 5 pages. So they're like, I'll read five more. Five more.
No, I mean, then they'll do this. And I'll be honest. Okay, they're going to read 5 pages. Okay, five more. If they go like this, read the last page, you're done. Because that meant in 10 pages, they know what the end is. Yep, that's the end.
And they're done.
Off.
They have to read your script to find out what happens the way it happens. Okay?
Or because they're just so engrossed, they have to keep reading.
I know. And I had an agent from William Morris come to one of my classes, and, you know, he started talking about the way that agent, you know, they don't even read your script. I mean, the big agencies, it's all covered, you know, blah, blah, blah. But when they actually, it gets to the point where they're reading your script, it's literally like, how many pages? And then they don't often read the whole script.
They just read dialogue.
They read just the dialogue.
They're not even reading the character name, and they're not reading all the stuff of what the character's doing. So if your characters don't differentiate voice,
you're done.
And they're like, who's talking? Because I'm reading this like this.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Right. You better, they're not reading the character's names. They're just, I should be able, mostly, to agree, do you agree, yes or no?
Yeah.
I should not have to read the character's names, because it should be so clear
obvious
who
talking.
Is talking. And they're reading really fast. So if you're... And I do this too as a writer, and then I have to go back and take it out because I'm trying to figure out. If you're like, and then she moved over here, and then she sat down, and you're putting all this crap in
you're
about
breaking
what,
up the
they're not reading that anyways.
So don't worry about it.
Don't worry. Just do it.
And you know, this is another psychological thing about scripts, just looking at the physical script, which you guys may not know. When they pick up a script and it's like a ton of words,
blocks
of action. They just go, oh.
No, they just jump.
They want it to look very spare and Japanese and lots of white space because it's going to be easier to read. And honestly, it's a psychological thing, but it's going to make them more open to your screenplay. If they pick it up and there's big chunks of monologues, they're just like done.
But this is also why you should be reading professional scripts.
Because you'll know
because
what
those guys,
like.
And they know how to direct, especially for action sequences, you have to learn how to write an action sequence.
Yeah.
They know how to direct on the page, and they know they're making the sentences are literally like three words,
yeah.
Three words, four words, three words. You never go over three lines down to the next, down to the next. They're making it almost like haiku, but it's very
you know
it actually
happening.
Gets your heart rate up because
yeah.
It's written in the tempo
mm-hmm.
of the action,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's very visual. They're kind of directing on the page, but you can't actually direct on the page.
But
they're visually directing on the page,
so that you know exactly what you're seeing on the screen. Now, have you ever read the Born Ultimatum?
That's great.
Is that Tony Gilroy, right?
Yeah. Tony Gilroy is
he writes these action sequences. If you guys have action sequences in your movie, you need to read Tony Gilroy because he does it so well. And he literally, he'll set you up the three locations that he's cutting between, and then literally there's no location slugs, and it's just like boom, they run down the stairs, and it's you know what's happening. You know, like the geography is so clear, and he's so crisp that you see the cuts as if you're watching the film in your on the screen. And it's a gift. And so if you do have action, read him because he's really good at it.
You should read a lot of great action scripts. I just had to have a scene that's action. I'm not an action writer. And literally my manager sent over like 20 of them because he was like, don't even give it to me until you
know
how to do this on the page. So that's just, everybody does that. You just have to learn how to write certain scripts.
Just on a formatting thing like that, one of the mentors got up and he said, things have changed so much there that you can write things like, a dialogue line, he wants to kill him, not in the dialogue, but as what you'd say would be an action bit, and then go back to the dialogue. Roy's taught you can never do that.
Mm-hmm.
You only what they're going to see or hear, but is that a new thing where you can put an intention?
I mean, you can do it, and you should also speak to this, because you're...
Because you're
reading more than I'm reading now. I think, as a writer, I would do that sparingly.
Very sparingly.
I would
do it when
I absolutely need to do it, like either because it's going to be irony, right? Because he's saying something the opposite of how he feels. You put that in parentheses, right? Or I would do it if I absolutely need you to know.
But you want to avoid it at all costs.
But Craig, here's the fear. If you do it too much, whoever's reading your script is going to go, this person has no idea how to write a screenplay.
Well,
yeah, that's
also let the actors act.
Right.
Let the actors
right.
act. They should know. But there can be lines that are either irony, the opposite. It can be said, like, seem like a very bland line, but what it really means is I'm going to kill you right now.
Mm-hmm.
But you just said you want a glass of water, but what I really mean is I'm going to kill you. And you know if the actor says that line in a certain way, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to give you a glass
right.
of water. You have to tell us that.
It's not obvious.
It has to be necessary to understand emotionally what's happening.
It can be done, though.
Yes, but sparingly.
But you heard what Meg said. Only when the way that the thing that they say, it's not clear their intention.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. But literally, like, three times in the script.
Jump in.
In television, I have to say, probably do it more.
In television, you do it more.
Yeah, because it's stupider.
It's stupider?
Like, you want to make sure emotion comes off the page.
Right.
So if you're doing something with any kind of subtlety, you want to think about your audience with television more. You know, reactions and things. I've told some of you to put more reaction on the page, and everybody's been like, no, you're not supposed to do that. And television a little bit more. People, you need to read to be emotional.
Right.
So walk people through it, but if there's a moment you really want to resonate, it's very underplayed or subtle.
See there, I just learned something.
Me too.
We
I'm like,
something.
See, we're all mentors.
It's helpful sometimes. Yeah. But for investors, for people outside the business, money, you know, sometimes you have to think about these things.
Well, it's funny, I've heard and I've done, you write different drafts for different readers.
Yeah.
Investors need more
info.
Hand-holding and info.
More info.
Actors need different things. They don't want you to tell them how to act. They want to, you know. But generally, you should just that's like kind of, you should just write one draft, and it should just be emotional. Honest to God,
yeah.
if your scripts can just be emotionally and emotionally get me, you're like halfway, three-quarters.
You're more than halfway, yeah.
Do you want to do, I have no idea what time it is.
It's 3:20.
When are we supposed to end? Does anybody remember?
3:45.
Do you want to do more questions? Do you want to do cocktail pitching? What do you want to do?
I have a question.
Yes.
At some point we were going to get to set pieces.
Yeah, I have a question about that too.
Oh, good. Well, I gave you a whole handout on it.
Uh-huh.
Did you
need
more?
Wait, what did you give them? Like a ton?
There's an awesome packet.
I know. This is amazing.
What are the questions about it?
What do you want to know how you use them?
I have heard conflicting definitions.
Okay. What are the conflicting definitions?
Some
you
are
come sit
a,
down.
The idea of there being a sequence that has a certain setup, and sometimes I've heard it visually, like, you know, this is the scene where they're in the castle, and that's the set piece. The set piece is, you know, and people will say, well, you know, it's a big budget movie, big set pieces. Is it simply setting?
No.
That, okay, see, there we go.
I mean, a set piece is a sequence, right? I mean, it's a sequence of events, beginning, middle, and end. It has a beginning, has a middle, and has an end, and a set piece takes everything, so it's emotional, it's moving the character, it's moving the plot, it's doing all of that, but it's a beginning, middle, and end, and it's, I think they're very active. It's action
more
based.
Expensive.
Yeah. They're big. When you think
large.
About it, they're large.
I mean, and indie films also have set pieces. Don't get me wrong, but they're big in some way. They're big. They're big moments. Mm-hmm. They're very, very big moments, and you know, movies need more and more of them.
I mean, how is it different from a sequence?
You know what? People define things. I mean, it's like everyone has a different definition.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's no right answer. A sequence, as I understand it, in the way I write them, is a series of scenes that has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Right.
So it is different than a set piece. But I don't know. Is it just defined by the fact that it's not large, or it's a smaller thing? But it's a series of scenes that have a beginning, a middle, and an end.
I mean,
that's
if you're doing an action movie, it's just a lot. It's a lot of set pieces. I mean, you can feel it when you're watching the movie, when you're starting to move into a set piece. The music starts changing.
I think of it as a budget term around here.
It's big. It's big.
Is it?
Right.
It's big.
Like, that's
it's a trailer.
A big day or a big 2 days where you're doing the set piece and you
right.
got to make sure. Like
but
if I'm doing a Christmas dog movie, it's the sequence where the dogs attack the girl and knock her over and everyone and all the props, everybody's there.
The whole town's there.
Of money.
It's snowing.
it costs you a lot of money because it's big.
Right.
It's a big event.
It's what you're going to use in the trailer.
It's the event. It's little events in the movie, but they have beginning, middle, and end, and they're very large, and they're probably turning on the structure points, too, often.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to, but they're big
they're
events because
moments.
They're climactic. The thing is shifting.
Yeah.
They're kind of these pressure points on the structure line, right? And things are shifting, and we're going to make out really big. And it's fun. It's unique. It's trailer, it gives me the tone. So it has to do all of the stuff we talked about in terms of core concept right now, from here to here.
And like in Dark Knight, remember the big rigs where they're doing that whole that chase thing? That's like it's a big set piece.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in the trailer. It's like, I wanna see that. That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's part of story, but it's also part of marketing in a way.
But it could almost stand alone in a way.
It could
yeah.
almost stand alone.
Yeah.
But it's big and it's beginning, middle, and end, and
mm-hmm.
it's exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And expensive. And cool.
And very cool. Totally.
So I rewatched Bridesmaids last night. So in Bridesmaids, when they're throwing up on each other, that would not be a set piece, or would that be?
When you mean the bridal shop?
The whole sequence
yeah,
the
bridal
of the bridal
shop is a set piece.
It's a set piece.
Right, okay.
Which we were just talking
and
about. I had no problem.
And you guys, the beginning of that is like her figuring out which Mexican restaurant to go to because it's
really
cheap, and then walking in, and then things are starting to get bad. People are starting to feel bad, and it ends with Maya Rudolph in the street with the wedding dress, which is my favorite moment.
That's a set piece. Comedies have set pieces. Indie films have set pieces.
Yeah.
They're just indie set pieces. They're, you know, spooky or emotionally upsetting, or they shift around, but they're just huge events in the story. They're events within the story.
And you remembered it. It's like,
it stands out.
The other one that stood out for me was when she's driving the car trying to get his attention.
Yeah, that's
it.
Yeah, that's a set piece too.
So basically, it's just kind of a.
It's not big, but it's funny.
Yeah.
It's very funny. Any other questions that haven't gotten answered?
About anything that you're.
Personally
experiencing,
whatever. Yeah. I'm kind of curious, Brenda, did you find that the exercise matches your script? Okay,
scarily.
Scary. Okay.
Yeah. But it also highlights, like, yeah, the where it needs to get digging a little deeper and where what's not clear. Like,
okay.
It's genius. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You should do your actor pattern next, and it'll get even more clear.
I was glad that it was clear. That's great.
You know, at lunch we were talking about just like why we write things, and you know, I was laughing as they were talking about it, because I was saying, you know, when my kids were really little and I was kind of staying home with them, I wrote a Prison Break movie. I have to get out of here. And only later did I understand it. I really wanted to write this Prison Break movie. But it was probably good that at the time I didn't really see the connection.
It's true. At different ages, you.
Yeah.
Everybody writes the self-indulgent coming of age. I've talked to some of you about this.
Yeah.
When you start out.
It's like in your
you just put yourself out there
yeah.
and you're still 15
yeah.
and whatever, and then you go past it. And
yeah.
you go to those other stories that are hopefully not just you. on the page because no one cares. At a certain, you know what I mean? You have to get beyond that to write stuff that more people will connect with.
And you know, it's funny. I'm friends with the guys who wrote Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. You know, when they wrote that movie, they were like 20, whatever, you know? And they just wrote a sequel and they're hoping to get it made, but it's...
That must
it's,
be hard.
But it's very, it's so cool because, you know, because I read it, they wanted feedback, and it was like, this is the perfect movie for the people who watched that movie when they were 24, because it actually applies to these two writers' experience as men in their late 40s, you know? It's just like, wow, because they nailed it. It's like Bill and Ted at 40, whatever.
So they didn't go back and just pick up where they were, and they took them. Which is really smart.
It was really, it's really good, but it's reflective of, as a writer, where you are in your life, and what... Yeah. What things you're attracted to writing, you know, at that particular
point. Right, so the thematic can keep changing, obviously. For your,
sometimes your theme changes, or it just shows new sides to it. Mm-hmm. But it sometimes can change. I have a question. Did you have a question?
Oh, I did. I was wondering if you can talk a little bit more about tone, because that's sort of a new phrase for me, and I'm not quite sure I've locked in on it.
Tone is hard to describe, like I said. I never know what to say other than that. I mean, what was I thinking of? I was thinking of, you know, people, like, if they have a ghost story, they just start naming other ghost stories, but there's, like, literally the tones of ghost stories
could be so different.
So tone is the feeling in, that you're having as you're, as a full, in terms of the whole movie, right, as you're watching the movie, are you... Or think about the trailer has to show tone too, right? Because it's setting the tone of the movie. Now, tone, of course, goes to genre. Certain genres have certain tones. Certain genres can have multiple tones. Which comedy are you doing? It can go to audience, right? Children's movies have certain tones. They can only push tones so far this way or that way. You know, if you say to me, family movie, I'm going to assume the tone is going to stay within a certain safety zone of tone. You're not going to be too disturbing. It's a family movie, right? So if you have to be very rigorous with your tone in a family movie, right? So even if bad guys are going to attack kids, those kids are going to flip the bad guy and get, you know, because the tone of that bad guy can't stay too scary for too long. You see what I'm saying? Because that's not why I took my kid to the movie. Right? But so tone, and some genres are like, you won't get it made because I don't know what this is.
Yeah. I was just going to say, like, my kids have just recently started watching movies, and there are a lot of them where the parent dies in the beginning.
That's
fairy tale. It's a Disney movie. The mother's dead.
It's a huge number where the parent dies, but they never go to a place where the kid is, like, so fully in... So the tone still stays there, even though you'll have this crazy thing. So, you know, it's not just that death happens, it's that there's something about, like, community coming together or, you know, or becoming your full self or something.
I mean, there can be scary moments in a kid's movie, but I'm telling you, just from a marketing angle, if you can't go skip on your DVR. So tone is really...
feeling.
It's a feeling. Is this overall tone sweet and inspirational?
Right.
Those, I mean, you know, Disney has their inspiration bucket. Disney, the new regime, has five buckets, and they will only pick movies. Does your movie fit into one of these buckets? One of them is the I don't remember what all five of them are. Do you know what? I can't remember. Yeah. But one of them is the inspirational bucket. Hence, you're seeing the Flipper movie coming out. Oh, there's going to be a lot of inspirational sports movies, right? Because that's what they've decided.
Sports, is
their,
animals.
Their bailiwick. I was talking about this with Lisa. Inspirational movies are practically cookie cutter. I mean, they're exactly the same if you really look down underneath the pattern. That's good. So if your movie is tonally an inspirational movie, watch 20 of them and do it. Don't start halfway it's an inspirational movie and then we've turned into something else. Because now I don't know what the movie is. Inspirational movies, they don't change those characters. They are definitely, nobody listens to me, I need to change the world characters. So I know that about, you know, like, they know, so you have to watch. Like, if you think, I want this tone, try to watch a bunch of those movies, and you're going to start to see, I thought that was the same tone, but it's not. It has the same plot. It has the same plot elements, but that's not tone. It actually has the tone of this crazy movie that has nothing to do with it.
And
you know what I mean? Like, just start watching movies. Yeah. When you're watching movies, think about tone. You're going to start to see it. You're going to, if you just bring it into your mind.
And it, start yeah, it. And in terms of writing your own scripts, like, we have to know what your tone is on page one. immediately what tone is this movie, and it has to remain consistent throughout your film, because I've actually read scripts where, you know, it's just, it's this, and then it morphs, and you're like, what the hell? Like, you, it has to be consistent.
Well, don't you think it's the voice of the stage directions as well?
Yeah,
and it's
totally.
The tone of every piece of it.
Right,
but
right.
Do you give me a paragraph
you're
about
telling,
a field,
you're
or
revealing
are you just like,
what
it's a field, you've seen it.
Yeah.
There's a huge difference.
Absolutely.
This is why you need to read scripts. Because watch how the great writers put tone into the first, you know, paragraph or opening of their movie. And their tone is in the writing.
Yeah. And
especially action scripts. That's just, the tone is just like hammering you over the head.
Yeah. But like people like Quentin Tarantino, I love to read because he kind of created his own tone. It's like, it's really funny and it's really dark. Like two tones that you go, no way can you put these two things together. But he puts them together and they're consistently weaving.
But they're consistent.
He creates this consistent tone of these two very light
and
dark.
He's never just doing drama or just doing comedy. He's always weaving, so it creates a new tone.
Yeah.
But it's consistent.
It's consistent.
He's not bopping out, bopping out, bopping out. Now I'm going to put a third thing in. Now I'm bopping over here. That just is like, I don't know what you're doing. I don't know.
Yeah.
What am I supposed to feel right now? Is what the audience is asking. What do you want me to feel right now?
Right.
Because I don't know. Right? Like, what do you want me to feel from this scene? Right?
Right.
You're trying to elicit an emotional response from every scene. Right? Does that make sense? It's really hard to explain tone. I almost feel like I have to like cut movies together of the same tone or something to watch.
Do you know what the tone of your movie is? Or are you struggling to find it?
I am struggling with it. I mean, like you said, I mean, it's the music thing kind of makes sense, but I'm not quite sure how I'm translating that onto the page. I mean, it's kind of like...
You're figuring it out.
I think in my business, I think about it a little bit because I'm in TV film, so like the lower end. But is sincerity versus insincerity? Those kind of things become very simple ways for me. Like, is this person approaching this head on, or do they have a tongue in cheek? Are they bantering for the sake of banter and trying to give me a voice that's insincere?
Yeah.
Or are they using it, you know, organically? Like, sincerity is kind of a measure.
The stage directions, that made a lot of sense. Cause, like, all the, you know, sometimes you can read something else, and like the stage direction is talking to you in a totally different.
Right.
You know, and then you're sort of like, so I get that. It's like now I know what it's not, but I'm not sure I could do any better.
If you read, I'm serious.
Read
if you read a bunch of scripts, you're gonna see it. You're gonna see it.
I just actually, to this, it reminded me. On YouTube, people have recut trailers for all kinds of movies.
Yeah.
And there's really funny, like, there's an independent feel trailer for The Shining. And it's
so funny.
It is
the
all
really good
people
one.
From, like, really it's good. Scenes from The Shining, but it's like, he needs a father and he needs a son. And it's this completely.
The Ferris Bueller Days Off is really good because it shifts tones completely and it shifts main characters. It's an indie movie based on the kid who wrecks the car at the end, who, by the way, is truly the main character in the movie, anyways, if you actually look at it. So it's this indie film about a boy.
Right.
His father's car.
Really,
they shift tone. They shift. How do they do it? Yeah, that's a fun way to see tone. That's a really good idea. It's
and
a
I
fun
can always sell them character descriptions too. If someone's into like they're this tall and they have brown hair and that, versus like you know she wears the funky jewelry and she's got this Northern California vibe about her.
Right.
That's different voice.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a question. It's a different topic.
Okay, go.
I'll switch topics, but I'm having an interesting situation with a project now. And I'm just wondering. As writers, or you know, as producers, you should have this. So I'm having some growing pains because I'm switching genres. You know, I may have mentioned I've gone from like Billy Elliot to Will Smith, and all the thematic and the drama of it and the heart of it, I love. Like, I fucking love it. I can't get enough of it. But then I go to write my because there has to be some action, and it bores the hell out of me. Like you know, I could fall asleep. You know, because I personally fast forward through all of the, like, you know, car chases and this.
And you're writing that movie why?
Yeah.
I'm writing that movie why because it's my heart. The thematic in the story is my heart. It's where I am now. It's just where I am.
I mean, the best action comes from character.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it is. It's a, you know, at the end of the day, it's about a guy who has saved the world from something else. You know, it's love. It's like... Who am I? It's all the stuff that inspires me.
You know, if you read the great action scripts, they're written very emotionally.
Right.
From the character's point of view. Mm-hmm. And then he looks this way, and he sees this. Bang! This happens. And then he does that. And it's a very visceral, emotional experience. It's not disconnected action. It is, you are deep in the character's point of view.
So that's the answer.
Something like the gray.
Well, but that's the answer right there. Because, see, that's been my problem. Mm. The answer is that it has to come from the character's, you know,
experience on the
of the action.
He's experiencing
the
action.
And I've been disconnecting at those moments. Like, oh, fuck, now he's got to escape the, you know, whatever. You know, I'm like...
No, but Duffy, I understand. No, Duffy, I understand because when I watch action movies and then they start the action sequence, I go to sleep. Like in my mind, it goes. Oh wait, here's dialogue, and I wake up. But what Meg is telling you to do is, don't think about them that way at all. Yeah. Write them as if you're writing a scene, and your character has to do this thing to save their family.
His response
and
to the action is his change.
Right.
Okay.
That's why it's in there. Otherwise, what's it doing in the movie?
Well,
if at the beginning of the movie, he was in a dark room, and he walked out and shut the door. And now we're back in a dark room, and he goes forward. I mean, watch... Okay, you want a great... I mean, watch the... What's the documentary about the guy who falls into the void? Is it called The Void?
Yeah, touching the void.
Touching the Void. Like, just vibrating action of what is he going to do, and being... You know, you should feel... The action. Is he stuck? Is he running? Is he dodging? Is he pushing? Is he punching? All of that should be from character, right? Or whatever the hell's happening to him. Yeah. He doesn't know what's going on. This thing is coming from this direction and that direction. Again, if you read it on the page, you can see how the masters keep you very emotionally
grounded
in that person's point of view so deeply, right? That, and yes, of course, isn't it cool that the motorcycle is going down the Trevi Steps in Italy? Yes. There has to be visual.
Yeah.
You're not internal. It's still visual. Right? Yeah. Very, very visual. What is the movie you said to read?
The Gray.
The Gray.
The Gray. So write that down, What is that about?
I don't know.
Joe Carnahan, the Alaskan oil workers who are leaving Alaska, and they crash in the middle of forest. And it's snowy, and then they... are trying to survive, and they've landed in the middle of a wolf's den. Mm-hmm. And now, on top of having to survive that, now they have to somehow get the wolves out. And they're trying to release it early this year because they think that Liam Neeson may get an Oscar nom for it. Mm-hmm. So he plays that character.
Cool. So there's tons. All the Bourne Identity movies are written really well.
Tony Gilroy.
That action I can watch because it's all driven by what he needs in that moment and his intensity of finding answers.
But as the writer, you just have to make that shift in your head when you go to write that sequence. That it's all about your character getting what they need
and
what they want.
That changes everything because now I realize what I do is I pop out of my character to get through it.
And then a different, once you get into that, you're going to have to take a pass where you're like, okay, this action is good, but could it be cooler?
Right.
I mean, you're going to have to do that. If there's action, right? I mean, they want a cool action sequence. Yeah. They don't want the same thing they've seen
a million times.
How can you take a train action sequence and make it different? That is your responsibility, too.
And I sometimes, as a trick as a writer, think, well, what if I did kill them here? What would that feel like if I'm writing it as if it really is going to go to that? Because I write outlines and then I get bored and then I want to do things differently. It's just sometimes a trick to play, and then at the end I'm like, well, I can't really kill them. We're only halfway through. But it's sometimes
but they can
fun.
Almost get killed.
Right.
And then it creates more drama.
I mean, if you can create an action sequence where you literally don't know how he's going to get out of it,
that
would be great.
That's what I can try to do.
But I spend 2 weeks trying to figure out how to get out of it.
But you know what? I actually do an exercise when I feel like things are just kind of go like this. Mm-hmm. And I always say, how can I escalate this? And literally go over the top. It gets worse and worse and worse and worse. And even if I end up pulling back, it takes me to great places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, think about that.
You know, whenever you have a chance to make it harder.
Yeah.
Make it impossible. I mean, great movies are impossible problems. At the end of Act One, I should think, I have no idea
how
they're going to get out of this.
Right.
Because if it's not an impossible problem, I've already started to kind of step back. I should be leaning in because... What would you do? I don't know. I should not know what I would do, and I'm so interested in what this character is going to do because it seems impossible. The more impossible the problem, the more the drama and conflict is going to come up. And that's for comedy, too. That's not just drama or action.
Like, how much more out of control can this get for this guy or this girl, whatever, you know, whoever your comedy lead is? It's very specific. And, and you know, Terry Zweigoff is another guy who's very specific. Did you guys see Bad Santa?
Yes.
Okay. It's like the tone of that is like, like here's the Santa at the bar, like the opening scene, and he like walks outside and just like, and just barfs, and you're like, you know what the tone is, but you know what the tone is.
But you gotta hold it now.
You gotta.
You can't
hold
go something super sweet. Now it's sentimental. Don't. It's okay. You can like him still. No. If you're gonna do that tone, do it.
He's a very bad Santa.
All the way. He's a very bad Santa.
You
can't soften him up now in tone. That's where you guys start to get multiple tones because you're actually afraid of the tone you've put out.
Right.
You got to commit. I mean, it's kind of my word of this retreat. Commit. Commit to tone. Commit to genre. Commit to the main character. Commit to the transformation or no transformation. Commit to, there's an one act to action. Not this soup stuff of thousands of things because, you know, it will fix the script. Yeah, no, it won't. It'll actually muck it up. But,
So you often hear a lot about like giving your protagonist some kind of humanity or vulnerability. So if you start with the vomit and the, you know, bad Santa thing,
there is always a crack.
And so I guess what would be an example of holding tone and at the same time showing the vulnerability or something?
Here's bad Santa. He's horrible. He like hates the kids who are asking him for toys. He's a horrible guy. He's a horrible guy. And literally at the end of the movie, he buys a little teddy bear for a kid. I mean, that's his arc.
But she's saying in Act One, where do you connect to him? Or is he?
Yeah.
Just,
how do you?
But is
he
an anti-hero?
You don't.
That's a bad example.
You don't connect.
Anti-heroes construct totally differently, so you have to watch tons of anti-hero movies and see how they're pulling them off.
Okay. Well, that was a bad example because I.
Yeah.
But I guess that's sort of my point. Like tonally, if you have something that's like really, you know, comedic or something, how do you have that moment that doesn't veer off?
Because it stays in the tone. I don't know.
I'm not clear on exactly what you're
asking. I've told my network executives if you put a dog next to a woman, it will make her more likable.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
If she likes the dog and the dog likes her.
Oh my god.
That's the cliche, but that's the cliche.
I mean, what they do with female characters is they give her a kid.
Right.
So now she can be as bad as she wants. As long as she's a good mom, we're good.
We love her.
I mean, you know. I said this in the Warner's prep. What they do with De Niro and stuff is he's really bad, 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 but then he, you know, can't go see his kid for Thanksgiving.
Right.
So it's a kind of, it's an empathy. You just have to get us one moment of empathy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Just one moment of empathy. And often it's in their longing, what they can't have, or who's being mean to them. You know, even though they're a hard-ass mafia guy, there's a worse one above them.
Yeah. Who
treats them badly. So at least you start to empathize with that.
And we feel their pain, right?
You feel their pain just for, you know, enough time. And I wonder, you know, I wonder about even anti-heroes. I think that that pain is, even though it might be far away, there's something there. Like in Unforgiven and stuff. But I don't know the answer to anti-heroes. I would have to go watch 10 of them.
Well, we love Clint Eastwood's character in Unforgiven because he has these two kids and he's willing to, like, do what he said he wouldn't do so that his kids can survive. I mean, it's like his motives.
Kids and dogs. That's good. Any other questions? You guys are just frying, I know.
Yeah, do you guys have any brain cells left at all?
No, I know.
Just like seriously.
All right, I guess that's it.
Want to attend a 4-day writer's retreat and be considered for the CineStory Fellowship? Enter the CineStory Screenwriting Awards online at cinestory.org/contest. The final deadline for the 2012 contest is February 15th. The grand prize, valued at over $17,000, includes $5,000 cash, free attendance at the retreat, and a 12-month fellowship program with 2 Hollywood pros. CineStory would like to thank Don Bowden for use of the track Home from his album This One's Gonna Leave a Mark. Don is a composer for film, TV and other media. To find out more about Don's work, visit donbowden.com. Finally, CineStory is a non-profit organization. So if you like what you hear, consider supporting these podcasts by making a donation online at cinestory.org/support us. Until next time, happy writing.